Hi, folks. It's Sam Cedar. It is Thursday, December, 30th? Wow. 2010 is almost over, and we are taking a just another couple of days of vacation. I got to be honest with you. It may have felt to you like I took more vacation, but I didn't. Feeling a little bit tired. As many of you know, filled in for Keith Olbermann the past couple of nights. That was fun. Sort of exhausting to do two shows a day. But I am awaiting the return of my family from Michigan with bated breath. And in the meantime, I have pulled from our archives a couple of interviews for you. For today, we're going to hear the interview that Janine and I did with George Carlin from the Old Majority Report. The quality of the recording, not so great, because it's tough to track down these archives in some instances, because the geniuses who sold Air America wiped all their hard drives clean. Be that as it may, please enjoy this George Carlin interview from the Old Majority Report. And tomorrow, I think I'll post an interview with Malcolm Gladwell and maybe somebody else. But we will be back live on Monday, and I'm going to wish you a Happy New Year's. I'm going to do it tomorrow, too. But for today, have a Happy New Year. Okay, enjoy.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is our honor to introduce to you our next guest. He is a comedian. He's a satirist. He is an author. He's an actor. He is genuinely a living legend. I'm, of course, speaking of George Carlin, and he is on the phone on the Majority Report. George, thank you for joining us.
Hi, how are you doing? Hi, Janine.
Hi. Thank you so much because of all the technical problems we had last time.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, when you're just getting started.
Don't I know it.
Yeah.
We barely have broadcast capacity on a daily basis. It's always really a celebration when we get a show done.
Good. It'll give you something to stand up and cheer for.
Yeah, and we do.
That's good.
Well, thank you so much. You know, I have to admit, I'm a little nervous to interview you because I know that you don't. I know that you have different views than perhaps Sam and I do about voting and about talking about the Bush administration, so I don't want to step on your toes in that way.
No, there are no toes to be stepped on, and anything you mentioned that you think potentially could clash with something, believe me, it won't happen. We just talk about the stuff we think's important to each of us, you know, and I can tell you how I got this way.
Would be a great starting off point. How did you get this way?
Well, it seemed like we ought to establish it this way first.
Oh, that's true.
Yes,
that's true.
We're very new at this. So,
yeah. Yeah,
we should have you on every interview.
Yeah, you're lowballing me here with this. We're really new at this, you know. But I appreciate that, and we should just roll it out. I don't. I can start from this point. I don't usually do. I don't. As a rule, and it's a pretty strict rule, I don't do any topical humor. I don't really like very much topical humor, and for me, I find it. I enjoy my writing, and I enjoy getting things just right for myself, and learning them, and grout and doing them. But the thing about topical humor is that, first of all, I don't want to be expected to come out every night that I do work. I work about 150 nights a year. I don't want to be expected to come out and have something to say about that day's events if something outstanding happened. So I don't like that sort of pressure, and I think it makes you sound like a lot of other people. And I kind of don't like that. I like having my own voice and doing things that don't seem dated. You know, I've done all these HBO shows and these, they're all out in CD and they're out in DVD, and I don't like it if there was something on there that just was really wasted now, you know. So it's perishable. You have to go back and do it again some more. You have to drop it 2 weeks later. I hate dropping something that I'm really fond of, something I wrote, you know. So It's a selfish thing, but I don't go into those things. I like talking about the broader picture, the one that maybe things that are true or from my standpoint, true now, true 10 years from now, true 15 or 20 years from now, things about the culture at large. So that kind of gives you my ground floor.
George, we have 1 minute before we take our first break, and then we're going to have a lot longer to talk. But sure. I think where my nervousness stemmed from is about voting and about George Bush. Now, I also don't like topical humor of mocking a president or something. I think it's easy and lazy. Not that, but I felt nervous about saying who are you going to vote for or what are your thoughts on Kerry announcing.
I know that you made that point earlier, and I kind of just bypassed it to go to the thing I wanted to establish about myself with topicality. But we can cover that other part of it, and believe me, I'm gentle.
All right, great. Well, we will cover that and more when we come back. You're listening to the Majority Report on Air America Radio. My name's Sam Cedar. Sitting across from Janine Garofalo, and on the phone, we have with us George Carlin.
There are 400,000 words in the English language, and there are 7 of them you can't say on television. What a ratio that is. 399,993 to 7. They must really be bad. They'd have to be outrageous to be separated from a group that large. All of you over here, you 7. Bad words. Those are the ones that'll infect your soul, curve your spine, and keep the country from winning the war.
Majority Report, Air America Radio. My name's Sam Cedar, sitting across from Janine Garofalo on the phone. We have George Carlin. George, when we left, we were talking about you don't like to do political comedy on a daily basis. From a personal, aside from performing comedy, what is your disposition towards the political process in this country?
Well, I personally, I don't participate. There are so many things to say about this. I almost have the need to give you kind of a bunch of points and then, explore any one of them. I don't participate. I think there's an ownership class in this country. I think the owners of America pretty much do what they want, regardless of what is what the so-called voters want. If I were dropped out of an airplane and there were a line drawn on the ground, I would fall left of center. I would because I think people right of center are interested more in property and property rights, and I think people left of center are interested more in human beings and human values and rights. So I would definitely be left of center. But I don't think the particular organization of parties that we have in this country really accomplishes anything outside of keeping people believing that there's actually a choice. People are made to feel free in this country by being presented with a series of meaningless choices for the most part. And I just don't. I think it's meaningless, and I don't participate because I think there are other people who can participate, do what they want, and vote, and have fun, and all that stuff, and really think there's going to be something different going on when all they do is move the furniture around a little bit. The owners of the country do pretty much what they want. They buy both parties. I mean, this country was bought and paid for a long time ago. Democrats, Republicans, if you look at the contributions, they vary a little according to certain industries, but for the most part, they're both sponsored corporately. And I don't care for business and corporations and that whole part of the way things have evolved. So,
have you always felt this way?
No, I voted. The last time I voted was for McGovern. And after that, I began to get a richer, I'll call it, education in this thinking. This thinking developed. I began to grow and educate myself about the system, so to speak. I don't know how, what other words to use for these things. But the system and how it functions and how victimized people are. I mean, the system is rigged against the average person, rigged against them. And they don't know that. They don't believe that. They buy the okey-doke. There's an okey-doke in America. It's the official American BS story that you're given when you're a child. Land of the free, home of the brave, all men are equal. Justice is blind. The press is free. Business is honest. Your vote counts. The police are on your side. It's great, you know, on a poster, but it doesn't play out that way. And I think people buy it because they want to keep their jet skis and their cell phones and their off-road vehicles. They want to keep the things coming. That's why the country is fat. It's physically because it's fat intellectually. There's no body of people in this country outside of a handful who really can talk about issues. When you listen to the things these people say on emails that are sent into these news channels or when people are questioned at the mall, it's absurd. The level of intelligence in this country is extremely low. I think the American people are a lot dumber than they're given credit for. And that's just how I feel.
Now, do you think it could get any better? And also, do you think it could get any worse?
I think we're definitely on the downward curve in terms of the lifespan of this country. Probably it seems faster than many other so-called empires, because we're only 200-plus years old. But then again, the speed of everything that's happened in those 230 years, whatever it is, the speed of the change and the developments has been a more rapid pace. So probably 225 years or so is comparable to, I don't know, for instance, Spain or England or one of the others that lasted longer because things move more slowly. I really think that this species and this culture in America have made very serious wrong choices along the way. This place has been turned over to, for the most part, the money traders and the high priests. And it's really embarrassing that a species with this potential, with this brain that elevated us above all of these other creatures, that we have settled for so little. And I am so discouraged by it that I have kind of just decided to watch it as an entertainment rather than consider there's any reason to care. I can't find a reason to care. I'm very good at helping individuals. I like one-on-one, my empathy is wide open. My altruism shines through. But when you talk about larger issues, I can't connect with them. I can't.
Well, you know, George, the thing is I agree with you in a lot of sense of a lot of people are dumber than they're given credit for.
Yeah.
And I actually, it kills me when politicians say the American people
yeah.
aren't stupid.
Yeah.
Well, since when?
Yeah.
You know, that's basically the grease that makes a machine go, is that politicians must build their careers upon ignorance and apathy.
That's right.
But I would say that willful ignorance probably is more than genuine dumbness. Is unfortunately overtaking, especially since 9/11, the electorate. And what I think there, while you're very correct when you say that both parties are bought and paid for, I do think that this time around there are gradations of intellectualism, whereas George Bush and his movement conservatives, as they call themselves, are the party of anti-intellectualism. They are the party of politicizing science, and they want to have creationism in schools, which is basically dragging us all down with them.
Right. Agree 100% that there are now extremes of the two. Well, the Democrats' extreme came to its height in the days of, let's say 12 years ago. But and then Clinton found his third way, the middle ground. But the Bush Republicanism is just way far. I mean, it is reactionary. And it's just it's cartoonish. Because they so dislike average people. They so want to just get fatter and fatter. And the way they've woven the church, the church or their God into all of this is a little bit. It would be frightening if I cared. I mean, as it is, I see it as a big freak show. I think if you're born in in the world, you're given a ticket to the freak show, and if you're born in America, you get a front row seat. And I enjoy watching it. And to me, it's all a big entertainment as it goes downhill, because there's no way you're going to get power back from these owners. There's no way. They got all the guns and bombs, all the money, all the levers of power. They can call martial law anytime they want. It's just too beyond this thing of voting or even rioting in the streets, which used to be at least reliable. So I mean, that you'd get some attention for it. Not anymore.
But actually, I would say that, yes, if, you know, there's a saying that if your vote mattered, you wouldn't be allowed to do it. But there is something to be said for organizing and protesting at certain levels, because
sure.
if it didn't work, we'd still have
yeah.
segregation, and women couldn't vote, and women couldn't avail themselves of reproductive rights.
That's right. I agree. And I agree with the proviso. The system, and forgive me for these sort of simplistic terms, but we need a vocabulary for this. The system has learned to bend when necessary. And getting out of Vietnam was a case in point. Not only was it did it seem that the public was going to revolt to whatever extent it could, but they saw that it wasn't in their interest any longer. The same thing was true, I think, of segregation. Women's all of these movements are effective, and I grant you that, and they do represent change. But the system has to be grabbed by the throat and practically choked for them to be, I'll call it, granted these rights, these liberalizations of policy and attitude. I think we have plenty of activists. You know, I think there are other people who watch the freak show besides the ones who are in it and the ones who sit there watching with a notepad as I do and most comedians do. And those are the ones who want to fix the freaks. And those are the environmentalists and the activists and the people on the picket lines and the people with petitions and the ACLU lawyers. And that's fine. We have people doing all those things. Wonderful. Count me out. I really don't think I count. I really don't think I count. And what I try and do is, in my work, I try to be funny and do things that are in my heart and on my mind. But if there's any kind of spillover effect, people say, well, do you try to make the audience think? No. I try to let them know I'm thinking. And if any of that brings some of these things into a brighter light, any of these things I like to talk about, into a brighter light, then that's my little contribution.
But actually, George, I would say that there is more credit to be given when you say, do you make the audience think? I would say that all good comedians worth their salt, and you're certainly one of them, are social critics, whether they mean to be or not. And you, just in your saying, and it's now oft used, very, very famous when you say about God, the man upstairs who's not good with money, right?
Yeah.
Now, just in that alone, you can't, I don't believe that's not meant to make people think, because that makes so many people go, oh my gosh, he's just debunked. So much of the underpinnings of televangelism and so much of what the church demands of you.
Well, I have to grant that somewhere along the semantic scale, I'm glad when they think, and that when I try to show off, I'll call it that, because that's what this job is. As you know, it's largely getting up and saying, "Hey, look at me, Mom. Ain't I cute? Ain't I clever?" And clever is part of it, and you want to show. I like to show them that I'm coming at something that we all, the general culture has been sort of gotten used to the idea of looking at things from a certain perspective, and I like going around to the side door and finding a different way in, and if I'm going to talk about an issue, then usually they're not limited in time like a year or this year or next election. Usually they're 10 or 20 year issues or more, abortion and race and these things. When I talk about one of these things, I like to show them that I'm thinking, that I come in the side door and show them an entrance they didn't know about, and then show them a floor plan, if you'll pardon this extended metaphor, that they weren't aware of. I like for people to see, look under the rock, to see things in a fresher light, and that's kind of my contribution. I've accumulated over these I guess now you could really count from the time that, I began more of a social approach to my comedy in the early 70s. I guess in these 30 years, I have had a lot of people who have become followers, fans, whatever the right word for that thing is, people who like your stuff and come back for more. And then we all grew together in the 70s, the 80s, the 90s. So I just feel that if there's an influence out there that happens from what I do, I'm happy about it. And it is true that when you show off, there's an element in it of wanting people to kind of be like you, you know. So you're right. I mean, I don't set up. People say, do you try to make people think? And I really don't. What I try to make them know is that there are things to think about, maybe. Maybe that's as close as I'll come to copping to that.
All right, well, we've got to take a break, but we'll be right back. And, George, when we come back, I want to talk to you about the media consolidation.
Yeah.
And I also actually want to ask you if you have disdain for your audience in some way.
Oh, wow.
As a comedian, or one who used to have so much disdain that I actually now have to be on radio. But we'll talk about that when we come back. You're listening to The Majority Report on Air America Radio. My name's Sam Cedar. Sitting across from Janine Garofalo, and on the phone, George Carlin. Welcome back to the Majority Report on Air America Radio. My name's Sam Cedar, sitting across from Janine Garofalo on the phone. George Carlin.
Howdy, howdy.
Hello.
How are you? All right, so before we get into the media consolidation, do you feel like you have some measure of disdain for your audience, or just sort of people in general? Because I mean, I think part of being a comedian is that you relate to people, but you have a sort of there's an arm's length quality to it.
Well, the public isn't a monolith. You know, they're not a group of identical individuals, and it's my conceit to feel that those who have come to see me are among perhaps some people who can appreciate some of the what I'll call analytical parts of my act. People who have been, people who come to see it at my stage for the most part are people who are already sold, already convinced, at least the majority of them. So I don't have disdain, really. My disdain is for groups. I love individuals. I'm really good with them. And I mean that. I meet people. I give them my contact. I talk with them. If they want an autograph and they have the equipment, I give that to them. And I listen. And I'll ask their name or where they're from. And so I have no problem at all one on one. I see the whole universe in the eyes of an individual. I think the potential, the human potential in each person, it just sings out to me. But when they sacrifice that beauty, that individual beauty, for the sake of groups, identity, belonging, that's when it gets lost, and that's what I disdain, is groups of these wonderful individuals who are kind of lost, really. And so I have kind of become a loner, an outsider by choice, and I enjoy that, but I don't really have disdain for people. And my audiences, I like them because they seem to be there for me. I don't mean just physically in the theater, that's very important, but they seem to follow why I'm saying what I'm saying and at least give me the courtesy of hearing me out. And they might go away shaking their heads, but I know a lot of them say, gee, you know, that's another way to look at that or something of that type.
Well, you know, you're fortunate in that that's true. You sort of have separated the chaff from the wheat audience-wise over the years because of your body of work. And I agree with you also that one-on-one people, all of them have a lot of potential.
Sure.
But, you know, there's a short story by Gustave Le Bon called The Crowd, which says that the crowd is only as great as its weakest link intellectually,
yes.
Which unfortunately tends to be true. And what happened to me was while I was touring after 9/11, I was still doing stand-up. I mean, I took a break and then was actually forced to continue with the tour because certain theaters threatened to penalize me if I didn't do that. So I continued to do it. I continue to do my, talk about my opinions on politics and the Bush administration. And as it got closer and closer to the invasion and occupation of Iraq, the crowds became unbelievably nationalist, tribal, basic, if you will,
yes.
And moving to anger so rapidly.
Right.
And these are the crowds that, you know, I would have said also, I'm pretty lucky after, you know, I've been doing stand-up since 85, and I've sort of managed to have people that come see me be people that, you know what they're going to see. Not,
yes,
and I don't
true.
Say that in an arrogant way. I'm just
no,
saying that...
You deserve to be able to say that because you have established an identity and you've established an audience.
But did you encounter anything like that? Have you encountered that, a sort of new nationalism or a new almost soccer hooliganism as pertains to your audience?
Well, because I don't get into issues of the day, it's probably not at all visible or audible to me. I do know this, and this is, it would probably sound obvious, but in the Dennis Blair opens for me, and he has certain things he does in his show, which they're not cutting remarks so much as they are some of the usual. He's clever and he does them well. I think he chooses good ways to do it, but they're kind of the usual things about Bush or someone. And I hear his show every night because I like to clock the audience from that. And he, the reaction he gets to the, let's call them anti-Bush or that whole thing, the reaction he gets has gotten so much more visceral and audible in his favor than it was when, let's say, you're right, when the nationalism first rose and the militarism and the jingoism and the xenophobia and all of these things were all these wonderful American qualities were being shown early after the 9/11. I call them the explosions downtown. That's because I won't use their vocabulary. You know, I will not use their vocabulary. So they're the explosions downtown to me. And I've only noticed that from my own standpoint. I don't have any barometer lines that could help, you know, help shed light on that.
You know, actually, I want to say that is so on point, the vocabulary. It really irritates me the way people speak about certain events, you know, 9/11, the day that changed the world. Well, actually,
yes.
It didn't.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
The rest of the world suffers a great deal on a daily basis in a myriad of ways, and I can't take the language that is used.
If I may, by way of adding, but indirectly adding to what you just said, I have to make a kind of left-handed plug for my book that comes out later this year called When Will Jesus Bring the Pork Chops? It'll be out in October, and it is like the first two. It's similar to the first two. And in the book form, because I've done three now and about 4 years apart, in the book form, I get a chance to stretch out more and to talk about specifics that I don't like to cover because I think of them as dated in terms of trying to do them on stage. But there's one called, there's one piece in it, for instance, or others.
George?
George, I'm so sorry. We have to, can you hang on and we'll come back?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay, we'll be back with George Carlin. Sorry.
Oh, that's okay. As radio.
You listen to the Majority Report on Air America Radio.
We are back on the Majority Report. This is Janine Groffler. I'm here with Sam Cedar. Also, our friend Bill Crowley is sitting with us. We have George Carlin on the phone. George, Bill, George.
Hi, George.
Hiya, Bill.
Bill is our newsman.
Yes.
Hey, George, it's Sam again. I have one more question that I just, as over the break, I was thinking about. I mean, this notion, I mean, I understand as a comedian not dealing necessarily with the politics.
Right.
But, I mean, surely... Well, not surely, but from my perspective, when I, you know, because I do feel at times that there are some things that are so systemically screwed up in this country that they can't change. But for people really on the margins, for the poorest of the poor, the most unrepresented of the unrepresented, for a kid in Iraq who, you know, no longer has arms or legs, maybe because of this war, there is a difference. I mean, maybe not on a broad societal scale, but on an individual, on a life per life difference, there is a difference to people depending on what happens with the politics of this country.
Depending on who's in power, you mean, who's in office?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, there certainly seems like that's a fair argument, but, you know, you'll never see a black in Hyannisport unless he's carrying a silver tray. These people who run on certain things and say that they believe certain things don't necessarily live them out. I just leave it to other people to decide if they want to be a real strong part of things or if they want to try to affect change. And that, I have no disdain for them. I don't hold them in any bad light. I just think I'm different, and I have never cared to do that. I think that the job is too huge to ever be done. So why should I chip away at something that I'll never have an effect on when I can take my removed point of view, my detached, emotionally detached point of view, and just report things through my filter, which happens to be, as I said, somewhat left of center, somewhat on the human side of things as opposed to property.
But you also have had an effect, and again, I know you were talking about your books. We want to get your book and also put it on our blog.
There was something in there about what you said, but I'll get back to that.
Okay, and when is Jesus bringing the pork chops?
When will Jesus bring the pork chops?
Okay, we're going to put that on our blog, but I wanted to also say something about whether you know it or not, how you are affecting change. Just your presence on television, whether it be the Flip Wilson show when I was a kid,
right.
Your visual presence was inspiring to people, the way you looked, the way
right.
the statement
sure.
you made by right. your hair. At the time, obviously, if you say to younger people, like our board op, Colin, is 23, he didn't understand why it was interesting that you had long hair as the hippy-dippy weatherman or whatever you did on Flip Wilson.
Right.
He actually said, was that strange that
yes.
somebody had long hair on TV? But you did, and you made a statement.
Yes,
and it reached people.
But let me point out, if by acting there's a passive effect, such as the one you mentioned, which was visual, or that there was a poem I did at that time called Hair, which was a way of explaining to people who, because the generation between I was 30 years old, and the young people who were affecting the society and beginning to change it were 20, let's say, and their parents were 40. So I was right in the middle in terms of age. And I used this hair poem to explain to the people who were 40 and 50 that there's no harm in this. Hair is fair is basically what the poem was about. So if I have had some gentler or passive effect with the things I say or the way I approach things, then I'm very satisfied making that contribution. I do think that were I to be more overt, I probably would, the message gets through, if there is such a thing here that we're sort of talking about the message. If the message, it always gets through when people are the least defensive, when their psychological arms aren't folded, staring at you. So rather than that, I've always used that in life, in any sort of persuasive situation that I'm in where I need to persuade, I've always tried to show that I was not a threat to you. I'm not a threat to you. And I like for audiences to know that my thing is my thing, and what they take with it and do is fine. But it sounds too much like you're trying to change people, I think, when you do it with a sledgehammer. I prefer the saber to the sledgehammer. It's my way. Each of us makes our own contribution. You know, Picasso spoke politically through his paintings, and painters have done that, and playwrights and so forth. So I speak my point of view, which, as I say, is not activist and overt, from the place I feel most comfortable and have found that it goes down better with, whether you want to call it a spoonful of sugar or just that the people are more, disarmed by good solid thinking and good solid humor than they are by trying to make a political argument to them that's only very thinly disguised. That probably describes me best.
George, this is Bill. I was going to say, I was going to say that from my perspective, they played a couple of clips. I don't know if you heard the clips.
Yes,
they played the seven words, and they played the thing about God.
Right.
Those are, you know, in the sense you're talking about, those are political bits, if you
sure.
want to look at it that way.
I mean
that sums up the whole First Amendment and
They're political/social, and I like that. but they're not topical, which was the thing I was sort of backing away from. And they're not about day-to-day politics, partisan.
The more solid approach.
The infighting. It's more about the larger political scene, the larger social scene, and how it's affected by these things. You know, my seven dirty words became a Supreme Court case.
Right.
And I had this pride, this perverse pride that I have, that I'm a footnote in American legal history. So these things don't go unnoticed by me, but I think if you let them be what they are, they have some effect, if we're talking about effect. If you try to push them and if you try to show that you have an agenda, I just think it would not go down as well.
That's the way we do it here. We don't come off with an agenda at all.
Right. And there's nothing wrong with a good sledgehammer. I admire the sledgehammer. It's just that my own style doesn't seem to allow for it. I've gotten through life more with the, call it sweet talk. That's an exaggeration.
How much is this media consolidation just wreaking havoc on our culture?
The number of sources for information opinion doesn't amount to opinions. All specialized, you know, websites and specialized places like The Nation and for the other folks, The National Review. So opinion shows up in lesser circulation. But in terms of the average American's large circulation, we both know the number of things that have been the number of important things. You know what's interesting to me? If it's important, your choices have been reduced and limited. If it's not important, there are more of them now. For instance, the less meaningful the choice, the more freedom you have. That's what I say. Bagels, donuts, cereal, tea, coffee, soup, the flavors they have. There are hundreds of choices. There are 400 different types of mustard now. This is the bread and circuses thing. This is what keeps people happy, thinking that they're free because they have these wide choices. But important things, the information sources, communications companies, which are pretty much the same, oil companies, insurance companies, accounting firms, political parties, these choices are very narrow, and these are the things that change your life or run your life. Whereas jelly beans, that must have 50 flavors by now. And we're told we have choice here. The only choice you really have in this country, as far as I'm concerned, is cash or charge, paper or plastic, because that's what your job is, shopping, consumption. That's what you're here for. It's the only reason your presence is tolerated, buying and consuming. And here's a couple other things you're allowed to pick, smoking or non-smoking, window or aisle, Pepsi or Coke. You know, it's just, it's more fun picking it apart from the kind of platform or standpoint that I employ for me than it is to, than whatever the alternative would be if I were a different person.
You know, they've added another level of choice, which you may or may not have noticed, though, extreme. There is extreme toothpaste, extreme juice, extreme pizza. Honestly, they've added extreme to everything. In fact, I bought on the way to work today extreme clean toothpaste.
Yeah. Well, the control of our thinking and our choices by marketing is just is legendary. The reason I wanted to mention the book, and I swear to you, I didn't come on here to plug my book because it doesn't come out till October, but there are about 60 pages in it devoted to euphemisms, and it's written in a prose style. It's not a list. It's prose style commentary about the things we try to hide from by giving them softer, sweeter names. And there are a lot of other things about language in this book, because language is probably my kind of hobby. If I had been anything else, I think a linguist would have been where I was drawn. There's a piece called Societal Clichés, such as America's Lost Innocence, Let the Healing Begin. And these things each have, 10 or 12 lines about them. He's smiling down on us. Every child is special. If it saves just one life. And then I have terrorism cliches, which are really interesting because one of them is the heroes who died for their country, talking about the explosions at the World Trade Center. They say, someone said, and this is a direct quote, I don't have my attribution here, but it isn't important. But someone said that naming Newark Airport Liberty International would be a way of honoring, quote, the more than 3,000 heroes who died for their country in the World Trade Center. Well, this is a debasement of language, because Stock traders, clerks, receptionists, cooks, waiters, and building maintenance people didn't die for their country. They died because they went to work. Not one of them would have shown up for work if you had told them they would die as a result. So you got to try and keep your heroes straight. We dilute our language and we devalue it, and therefore everything goes. You know, not everyone who died in 9/11 was a hero. It's a very special word. It should be reserved for very special people. So there's a lot of that kind of stuff in this book, and I'm very proud of these things because I take a lot of time with them, and I try to get them right from my standpoint and write them well so that they're interesting and fun to read. So I just wanted to touch on that because, you know, you bring up the language, the extreme, or all of the adjectives of our time, I think the piece is called. The adjectives of our time. So I agree with you, and I love it. I got 2,000 files in my computer, and it's full of stuff that I just have a lot of fun with, and about half of it is devoted to these, let us call them, slightly more serious issues, you know.
All right, George, well, we have to go. I want to thank you so much.
Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you.
George, we want to invite you to visit our blog at majorityreportradio.com.
Okay, and I will do that.
Our bloggers will go crazy if you comment on it.
I'm hoping you will get a Los Angeles outlet on AM radio that isn't part of the, quote, Inland Empire. That's where the only one is that they told me about that I thought I'd have a chance of getting, and I did not.
We're working on it. We're streaming on the web at AirAmericaRadio.com. But, George Carlin, thank you very much again.
Thank you very much, both of you, and I hope I didn't make anybody feel bad.
No, not at all.
Okay, good.
Thank you.
Too much political humor, though.
Take care.
You're listening to the Majority Report on Air America Radio. When we come back, Jerry Quigley.